Today at 1 on Hometown Heroes, part 2 of an incredible story of survival. We've heard about his experiences as a prisoner of war. Now this 94-year-old veteran talks about surviving a tragic plane crash in 1946.
Out went the door, and I went out with it. And I don't think that I was 500 feet in the air. I pulled my ripcord, and I was on the ground that quick.
So how did he get out of that? And how has his story come full circle 65 years later? You'll hear it all on Hometown Heroes, today at 1 on News Talk 580, and now airing again at 5 o'clock on FM 105.9 KMJ.
News Talk 580 KMJ presents Hometown Heroes, honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, with you every Saturday afternoon here on News Talk 580 KMJ. Remember, we're also airing now at 5 o'clock on the FM side as well. That is FM 105.9 KMJ, 5 o'clock each Saturday, in addition to our 1 o'clock time that we've had forever here on the AM side. Each week, we visit with veterans of World War II, primarily here in the San Joaquin Valley, but often elsewhere. I've learned time and time again that no matter where your hometown is in this great country of ours, there are heroes in your hometown, men and women who've served and sacrificed for the freedom you and I enjoy every day. So as I exercise my freedom, travel around the country following the Bulldogs and announcing their sporting events, I often catch up with veterans in my travels. I was recently up in Idaho and met the veteran you'll hear from again this week. The goal of this show, of course, is to honor our veterans, to preserve their stories so we don't forget the price of freedom or the great efforts that have been undertaken to keep our nation free. And along the way, I hope we're entertained. We learn a thing or two from these members of our greatest generation. I've learned a ton. And every once in a while, we can't fit everything into one program with a veteran. And when it comes to Frank Avery of Lewiston, Idaho, that was just not going to happen this time. I could not let you miss out on the story of how he survived a tragic plane crash less than a year after World War II ended. We're going to get to that story. If you missed his World War II story last week, check out the podcast at kmjnow.com and you can get all caught up. Frank actually had a couple more things to add about his experiences after bailing out of his burning B-17 as well. Here's a taste of how he described those tense moments in the skies over Germany last week.
Just as we got hit by the fighters, my oxygen tanks exploded. And I can remember the white flame just enveloping me from the oxygen tanks. In other words, no more oxygen. Then I looked out over the wings and I saw all the wings was on fire. We had two engines shot out. I called up the pilot, the co-pilot. I said, "We're in bad shape. Let's get out of here." And about that time, they rang the bailout bell. And my parachute was at the chest pack and was hooked up behind the pilot. So when I got out of the top turret, I had to take that chest pack and clip it on my parachute. And I was the first one. I think I was the first one out of the airplane. As I was going down the hatch to go out the front escape hatch, the navigator said, "Don't go, don't go." I said, "Get out of my way." And out I went. And I probably delayed my pulling my parachute for about 20 seconds. That's what you was told to do. Wait till you get down to lower altitude so you don't pass out for the lack of oxygen. And I landed in that forest. I walked around a little bit in the forest, and all of a sudden, I heard a shout, and lo and behold, there were two Germans with guns, and I became a prisoner, and I ended up in a German airfield, and my whole crew was there when I got there, except my pilot and my ball turret operator who got killed, and from then on, it was quite a journey.
And as he described last week, he spent nearly a year as a prisoner of war. But after that, when he was finally out of the prison camp, but still in German territory, hadn't met up with Americans yet, there were a couple anecdotes that he remembered. He wasn't able to share them with us last week, so we'll hear those from Frank now. Again, go to kmjnow.com to hear everything he shared with us on Hometown Heroes last week.
So we walked down the road and get down the canal with the side of the road and tried to find some place to get across. We couldn't, so I told the lieutenant. I said, "Hey, let's go back, walk across the bridge like we're a couple of dumb Frenchmen and nobody will bother us." So we went back, we started across the bridge, we got almost across. This German officer hollered at us, said, "Come as you here." So we went over, and you know what he wanted us to do? we pushed his motorbike and get it started. So we pushed it down halfway across the bridge, started, we turned around and kept on going.
Wow, that's great. So now, they could have had you right there.
And then you remember the German civilian that hid me out in the barn?
Yeah, of course.
Well, with this, I wish I could have put this in the story. But next morning, I acquired myself a German bicycle, a motorbike, you know?
Right.
So I get on, and I'll go up the hill, and I'm going to really thank him for hiding me out. And when I get up there, his wife was crying. He hadn't come home that night. So I figured he was either dead or he was in what we call a prison camp, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So I went down the hill and walked into the compound, and I said, "Hey, where are you keeping your prisoners at?" He said, "Well, right around the corner." So I walked around the corner, and there he was in a fenced compound. He seen me come over, and I said, "What the hell did you do?" He could speak a little English. And he said, "I had a gun on me." Well, I went to see a couple of people. I seen a lieutenant colonel and a couple of captains, and I said, "Hey, this guy saved my life. How about me taking him home?" They opened the door, left him out, and I put him on the back of the motorbike, and up the hill I went. Well, I tell you, when I got to his house, all the family was there, my God, crying and all. They treated me like I was him, you know?
Outstanding. I'm glad we're able to attach that addendum to last week's show. And now we're going to move forward. I hope you're following all of this. When Hometown Heroes continues in a moment after a word about one of our new sponsors, we're going to explore what might just be the most dramatic and amazing chapter of Frank Avery's life, the tragic plane crash in the mountains of Montana in 1946. He is the only survivor, and it was history that was pretty much buried on a snowy mountain for 6 decades. But the last few years have brought it all back, and we'll hear it all from Frank Avery of Lewiston, Idaho, when Hometown Heroes continues next on KMJ.
It's as simple as ABC, friends, no teeth.
I can remember hearing that jingle on the radio for years, but I didn't really understand what it meant until redoing my shower a couple years ago. This is Paul Leffler, proud to welcome Fresno Distributing as a sponsor of Hometown Heroes here on KMJ. The knucklehead who tiled my shower, that would be yours truly, left a decent-sized hole around the shower arm. I needed an oversized flange to cover it, and I went all over town. None of the chain stores had what I needed. Finally, a merciful soul asked me, "Have you tried Fresno D?" Fresno D, as in duh, why didn't I think of that in the first place? So I quickly took the 41 to the McKinley exit, walked into Fresno Distributing, and bumped smack dab into the owner, Steve Cloud. He said he was sure they had exactly what I needed, and of course, he was right. Now I make Fresno D my first stop, whether I'm looking for one of those obscure plumbing parts or a top-of-the-line appliance, like the new Electrolux energy-efficient washer and dryer set my wife picked out. They have all the other top brands, too. Don't make the mistake I did. If you want your first stop to be your last stop, make a beeline for Fresno D. And while you're there, tell them thanks for supporting Hometown Heroes on KMJ. A high school where 98% of graduating seniors go to college, where success on the SAT and advanced placement or AP classes outpaces almost every other school in the valley. Home to a student newspaper that hauls in national awards on an annual basis. Its sports teams capture section championships. Have you figured it out yet? The school is Fresno Christian, and it's not just a high school. Fresno Christian offers a complete K-12 curriculum delivered by supremely qualified, experienced teachers who connect with their students personally, intellectually, and spiritually. Go to FresnoChristian.com to learn more about the value of a truly Christ-centered education. And if you want to see for yourself, call 299-1695 to schedule a campus visit. Whether it's kindergarten, high school, or anywhere in between, you'll get a genuine feel for what Fresno Christian's commitment to excellence could mean for your student. That number again, 559-299-1695. Fresno Christian Schools, education with a higher purpose.
On the front line of freedom, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler on News Talk 580 KMJ.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. Again, if you missed last week's program and the story of Frank Avery's World War II service and his time as a prisoner of war, you can listen to that interview in its entirety anytime on KMJNow.com. There are some neat photos relating to Frank's story there as well. But you might remember that when we finished last week's show, he left us with a bit of a cliffhanger. He said he'd love to tell us another story, but clearly we didn't have time left in the hour at that point. So that time is now.
Well, this story is the one that I think maybe is most difficult to believe and believe that you survived, and probably the hardest for you to believe. So this is about a year after World War II?
I enlisted in the Air Force, and I went to Wright-Patterson, Dayton, Ohio. Well, I start flying as a flight engineer, and I flew on B-25s, C-47s, and and different kind of aircraft, and plus the C-45. Well, on May the 4th, 1946, I was assigned as a crew chief to fly to Seattle, Washington, where with a crew that was going to be closing up contracts that they had with the air, with the people. And our pilot was a pilot named Major Van Fleet. And there were six aboard, and it was only a small airplane. It was for four passengers, two pilots, and I was an extra, so I slept. And when I was nothing to do, I'd lay down on the parachutes. We left on that morning. We stopped at Ellsworth Air Force Base and stayed in the hotel down at Rapid City, South Dakota. And then next morning, we went to Billings, Montana, where we serviced to get enough gas to make the hop over to Spokane, Washington. Well, I always made it a habit to listen to the pilot being briefed by the weather people. So after we landed there, they went and got a bite to eat, and me and my crew chief, we refueled the airplane, checked it over, and went back in. About that time, the weather person at this civilian airfield was briefing Van Fleet about the weather. And he said, "Major," he said, "there's a hell of a storm out ahead of you." He said, "Wait for a couple hours, and it will move out. You'll have clear sailing." Van Fleet says, "No, let's go." So 20 minutes later, we're in the air, flying towards Spokane, Washington. Now, understand, we're over Montana. About an hour later, we hit the storm. We were all over the sky. I know the times we dropped. We were 12,000 feet when we hit the storm. When I bailed out of the aircraft about 20 minutes later, we were probably down about 6,000 feet. We got a bit tossed around. I remember hollering to the pilot. I said, "Let's make a left turn and get out of here." Anytime you're in trouble with an airplane, the pilot always turns left so he's in control. He's not looking to the right. He's looking to the left. So we did, but we never did get out of it, and they didn't. I was being bounced around, and I think that I inadvertently got hold of the escape door latch and probably pulled it. Well, out went the door, and I went out with it. And I don't think that I was 500 feet in the air. I pulled my parachute ripcord, and I was on the ground that quick. And I landed right on the edge of the Shields River in the Crazy Mountains in Montana, right near a town called Wilsaw, Montana. When I landed, I was fortunate. I landed in a muddy area right on the edge of the water. Now understand, this was spring and the water was high. It was roaring. And I got pretty wet. But when I hit the ground, my feet sunk in the mud. And I think that's the only thing that kept me from breaking my legs. Well, anyway, I gather up my parachute and I saw a small shack in a little clearing. And I went there and got inside and kind of figure, well, Frank, what are you going to do? Let's take a look at this situation. Well, I had cigarettes, which I smoked then, and had some matches, and I started a little fire, and I got dried out pretty good. And I stayed there about an hour and thought to myself, what am I going to do? Well, I said, Frank, there's only one thing you do. Follow the river. It'll take you someplace. So I start following the river, and I ended up about 17 miles later, right when it was getting dark, I seen a light in a building. Now understand, I was swimming this river from one side to the other. I couldn't go any farther here. I'd have to go across. I know a lot of times I waded it. Other times I had to swim. And when I'd swim and get to the other side, if the clearing, I'd run as fast as I could to warm up, so I knew I was going to have to do it again. Well, I come to this beautiful little old shack. It was a farmhouse, and I seen this light, and I knocked on the door. And the door opened, and what's looking at me is a guy's rifle pointing right at me. I said, whoa, I said, I just bailed out of an airplane. He said, I heard you over this afternoon. Well, it was a guy named Koning, and he had a little daughter there, 3 years old, and his wife. And she looked at me, and she said, take your shoes off, take your clothes off. She gave me a blanket. She dried all my clothes and put my feet in hot water. And by that time, I was, you know, about an hour, 2 hours, I was in pretty good shape. So he took me to a little town called Wilshaw and took me to a bar. And first thing the bartender says, what do you want to drink? I said, a shot of whiskey. So I drank that. Then I thought to myself, what in the world am I going to do? So I asked the bartender, I said, telephone. He pointed to it. And I went over and picked up the telephone, and I dialed the operator. And I told the operator what was going on. I says, I want to make a collect call to the airport at Billings, Montana, because that's where we left from. She said, well, I can't do that. I explained to her what happened. She said, oh, yes. So she put the call through, and a guy come on. He said, oh, Lord, we've been hoping to hear from somebody. He said, the plane is reported overdue. Would have been out of gas. Well, and he said, stay right where you are. He called the Great Falls Airport, Great Falls, Montana Airport, and they ended up telling me, he said, they called me then, and they said, go to the hospital in Livingston, Montana. So they two guys, one was named Swallow, and I forget the other guy's name. They took me to the hospital. They checked me over real good, and they said, hey, there's nothing wrong with you. So I went to a hotel. Next morning, they showed up. The Army people showed up, and they started the look for the airplane. They had no idea where it was. But it was a lot of snow. It was bad weather. And about the fourth day, it cleared up. The rescue team chief asked me to come in. He said, where do you think it is? I said, show me where I bailed out at on the map. He showed me. I said, well, the airplane has got to be straight east, probably about 10 or 15 miles. Well, that afternoon, they sent a couple of B-17s up, and they were looking the area over, and one of the guys from the B-17 saw where the saw trees were down, and he saw where the airplane went in. Well, they had the Army went up there with friends of mine, who I found out later. One of the gentleman's dad led the rescue team up, and this young man went. He was 11 years old. He went with them, and he watched them take the bodies out of the airplane. And there's a description by Wesley's father. It says on the side of the airplane, they buried the pilot's skull by the airplane. It's right on. It's still there. And this is an old story. But the thing is, we went to Montana. I ended up with to the airfield. I ended up with double pneumonia, and I was sick for a long time. And at the Great Falls, they took me in to view the bodies, which was terrible. And then they sent me on a train. I went back to Dayton, Ohio. Well, I didn't think too much about the wreck. But years and years and years later, I'm talking 60 years later, my second wife passed away, and I was footloose and fancy free, I guess you say. And I decided to go to Montana and see if I could find out anything about where I was in trouble at. So I called the newspaper people there, and I told my story, and they said, we want to make a story of that. And then they said, come on. So I went out, and that's when I met her. That's when I met my new wife. They took me out, and I really couldn't find anything. I couldn't find the shack where I'd hid out the first couple hours. But after the photographer and the reporter, we cruised around with my daughter and her husband in a big truck. And we finally come back to a place, and it was a house, and we went in there. And it ended up that It was the house where I'd knocked on the door in 1946, but it had been moved across the river. And I told them who I were, and they said, oh, Lord. They knew that there was a survivor, but they had no idea that I was alive. And I was called the Legend of Wilsaw. So we went on, but we went back to the little bar where I'd been all them years before. And the bartender there said, oh, yes, yeah, I go up that wreck all the time. A lot of people make an excursion to climb that mountain to go see that wreck. And in the summertime, all kind of people do it. Well, anyway, I ended up doing some other things. Then I had a friend of mine named Warren Keller, who was reenacted the Lewis and Clark movement that in about 10 years ago, they reenacted the trip. And he was known as Private Shields. And remember now, I bailed out near the Shields River. So Lewis and Clark named Shields River for Private Shields, who was one of the crew on that trip. So Warren was named, also known as Private Shields. Well, he went back to where he was curious about the area, so he went back and he talked the forest ranger and all into taking him up to the wreck. Well, they got him up there. Matter of fact, he brought me a cylinder from the airplane, which I have here, and later on, he called me and he said, I'm coming to Montana, or to Idaho. He says, we're going to reenact some of our trip. He said, and I'm going to charter a helicopter and fly us over the wreck site. So he came, spent the day here with us, and we headed for Montana. We got there, and next day, the helicopter met us at the little airfield, and we take off, and we couldn't find the wreck because the pilot had the wrong coordinates. So then we went back and landed, and he said, tomorrow morning, I'll get the right coordinates. We'll meet again and go out there. So the next morning, it's cold, about 6 o'clock in the morning, and he says, I know where it is. So we take off and we fly straight east, and there it was. There's a wreck. Been there for 60 some years. The airplane is in the center of the picture I took, and then the wing has slid down from the snow melt and all that. Well, anyway, we went back to the little town Wilsaw, and we went to have breakfast. Well, we're having breakfast, and a lady come up to me, and she said, there's somebody wants to meet you. Well, this person turned up to be the three-year-old daughter that Mr. Koning, who took care of me when I first got to his little house. Well, she was there, and I met her. And then a little later, a young man came up to me, and he said, my father wants to meet you. Well, his father, Wesley Harding, and he was the young man, was 11 years old when he went up to the wreck site with his dad. So we had quite a reunion. And then we went back, then we come back here. And we went back a little later. You know, I never did find the spot where I bailed out. Well, Wesley knew where it was. So Esther and I and friends from Seattle, the Spraggs, we went back and we met him. And he took us back through the goddess country we've ever been through, across the river and all this. And then he said, there is the shack where you was at. And it's just a pile of lumber, you know. And then I took a picture of where I bailed out at. And now I'm in the process of writing this story. If I can get some help from a couple experts, I can finish it.
Well, I hope that happens soon. And let me know so I can let our audience know. And we'll finish Frank Avre's story when we come back. You heard him talking about returning to the crash site and meeting people who remembered it all those years ago. But what about the other men who were on that plane back in 1946? The six men who did not survive. One of them happened to be from Fresno, California. We'll get that twist and more when Hometown Heroes continues next on KMJ. What do you think of when I say Fresno D? Probably that catchy little jingle, right?
It's as simple as ABC, Fresno D.
Paul Leffler here to tell you what it means to me. It means Fresno Distributing selection of top-of-the-line appliances at wholesale prices for you, me, and everybody means you don't have to go anywhere else.
Since I started hosting Bulldog Coaches shows in Fresno D's showroom a few years back, I've gotten to know the owner, Steve Cloud, quite well. I know that some of his favorites are King Tut, Coca-Cola with real sugar in it, and of course, the Bulldogs. I know not to challenge him in gin rummy because he's a former world champion, no joke. But the other thing I know, and here's why my wife and I picked out our new Electrolux washer and dryer there, I know the Cloud family has been carrying the best appliances you can find anywhere since 1946. Bosch, Frigidaire, Maytag, JennAir, KitchenAid, Wolf, you name it. They have it. Don't just take my word for it. Go see for yourself at Fresno Distributing on McKinley between Blackstone and 41. Plumbing, lighting, electrical, kitchen, bath, whatever you need, Fresno D has it. And you won't find friendlier or more knowledgeable service anywhere. A locally owned business with great prices, great selection, and great service. Why go anywhere else? Still as simple as ABC, Fresno D.
Hey, this is Paul Leffler, and if you've been listening to KMJ for any length of time, you've probably heard me wax poetic about my hometown of Las Banas at one point or another. Every city has its secrets, and I'm going to fill you in on one my old neighbors have been keeping for 40 years. No matter where you live in the valley, you probably go through Las Banas every once in a while, so next time you're cruising down the 152, pull into Ming's Restaurant. The owner, Paul Cito, has been showing off his skills in the kitchen there since 1968. He has perfected the best Mongolian beef this side of the Great Wall. Delicate rice noodles underneath tender slices of beef with a flavor I can't even put into words. Whether you prefer mild, medium, or spicy, you'll be coming back for more. Ming's is closed on Mondays, so don't say I didn't warn you. But stop in any other day and try the pork wonton soup, Chinese chicken salad, or get everyone's attention with the sizzling chicken and vegetables. The possibilities are endless, but they all have one thing in common. Ming's time-tested commitment to taking your taste buds on a thrill ride. Ming's Restaurant, 435 West Pacheco Boulevard in Las Banas.
This is Hometown Heroes. Honoring everyday Americans who answer the call of duty on 580 KMJ.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. Coming down the final stretch now with 94-year-old Frank Avery of Lewiston, Idaho, from parachuting from a burning B-17 and spending a year as a prisoner of war in World War II. To surviving that horrendous plane crash in Montana shortly after the war. His story has been pretty captivating, I think you'll agree, and we are not done yet. Before the break, Frank was sharing about his return more than 60 years after the crash to Montana's crazy mountains. At KMJNow.com, you can see a photo of that wreckage that Frank snapped from a helicopter hovering overhead. He talked about meeting people who remembered the crash, people who for decades believed any rumored survivor of that tragedy was just a legend of Wilsall. Wilsall, that city of about 250 people near the crash site. But that isn't the only door that his pilgrimage ended up opening. There are some mementos he wouldn't have now without the story coming full circle. And he's been able to help others find out meaningful information, too, in the years since. Remember, Frank was the only survivor of that crash. But what about the ones who didn't survive? Let's explore that angle for the story now. Once again, here's 94-year-old Frank Avery.
I met the daughter of Major Simmons, who was sitting in the co-pilot seat. She found out through some way through that I was still alive. Well, she called my daughter in Oklahoma, and my daughter called me, and I called this young lady, her name is Andy Thomas. They come out to visit me. We had a great talk, and they was always worried because the co-pilot was not in where he should have been flying. And I told him, I said, Major, your father had nothing to do with the accident. It was strictly the weather. And also, it was a pilot's error leaving when he should have stayed. And anyway, we had a great reunion. Well, she came back to Wilsaw about 2 years ago. She exercised like mad, got in good shape, and she and her husband and all the friends of Wilsaw, they climbed to the wreck site. Well, at the wreck site was still my toolbox. So I told her, I said, when you get up there, you bring my toolbox back. Well, my toolbox is in Montana in Wilshaw. Esther and I are going over this summer, and I'm going to pick up my toolbox. Now, folks, that is the end of the story, and I want to tell you, I'm glad to be 94-year-old and alive and in good shape. Thank you all.
All right. Well, not so fast. I've got a couple questions for you about all that. Wow, where do I start with all this? First of all, to fly over that again, to see where that plane was, what did that mean to you? Did it make you even more amazed that you survived? Did it bring the whole experience back to you? What was that moment like to hover over that crash site in this wilderness?
Well, when I looked down and seen it, I was trying to take pictures, but I was crying. I felt so sad for those six people that died. Whether it was my fault, I pulled the door open. I didn't mean to pull that door open, but it could have hindered the airplane gaining altitude. They were only 850 feet from clearing the top of the mountain, and they did hit right into the hillside upside down. So you can understand what kind of terrible, terrible weather it was.
And when you bailed out and hit the ground, and you hit the ground immediately, like you said, if it wasn't snowy and muddy, you would have been incapacitated and not able to walk and run. Was it clear in your mind that no one else could have survived that, or were you wondering if maybe someone else made it?
Well, you know, the thing is, in a situation like that, I'm down here, they're up there yet. Did they make it out? I didn't know whether they had got back to Billings, Montana, because that's where they would have headed for. If they would have cleared the mountains, that's where they went. Then I'd have been in trouble. Here I am walking out of the mountains, and there in Billings. But when I made the phone call to Billings, and they told me that the plane was overdue, I knew that it was bad, that nobody was going to get out of it.
And you told us a story about the daughter who was tiny when her father was killed in this plane crash, and you finally got to meet her. We can imagine what it meant to her to have some closure and to know what her father's final moments were like and what had happened that day. But for you, after everything you dealt with all the years from this crash, to be able to provide that for her, what did that mean for you to be able to give her something she couldn't have gotten from anybody else?
Well, you know, her mother and Andy, they all had an idea that Simmons being in the right seat was part of the problem caused the crash. And I told all of them, I said, no, he had nothing to do with it. The pilot was an expert pilot. He had flown 30 missions over Europe, had the Distinguished Flying Cross, and had a great career ahead of him. But it was what happened. It was the accident report, which I have a report of. It's all pilot error.
So you were able to give them that peace that they their whole life they wondered, and now they finally had this closure. And there were other people on that plane. You're the only one of the seven that survived. But one of the guys who died, and this show originates every week on a radio station in Fresno, California, and that was the hometown, Marshall Tetzel, a guy on that plane. You remember anything about him, or had you only seen him that day on that airplane?
He was in the first seat right behind the co-pilot. The reason Simmons was up there on the co-pilot seat was they were talking business, you know, and not realizing something was going to happen. But when we landed at Ellsworth Air Force Base and we went to the hotel, he and I had a beer. And we had a long talk, you know, talked about where he was from and all. He youngly married, and he is really the only one that I had any discussion with until I left the airplane. But he was a nice-looking young man.
And at some point you met with his sister?
2 or 3 months later, after I got back to Wright-Patterson, one of my crew chief friends came up to me and he said, guess who I run into yesterday? Well, they were in an airport in Fresno, California, and they were in a hotel in a lounge. And he said, I run across Teasdale's sister. And they had a long talk, and that's, I guess, the only time that she knew that I was still alive, you know. And, of course, that was only 6 or 8 months after the accident. But it was just one of those coincidences.
Now, and I know this is a tough one to answer, but I'm sure it's something that you've dealt with throughout all this time. How often in the, what is it now, more than 65 years since this crash occurred, how often have you encountered the feeling, why me? Why did they all die? Why did I survive? And how do you deal with that?
Well, it's tough. I would say for the first two or three years after that, I had a light nightmares about it. When I was in prison camp, boy, I'd wake up at night hollering, you know. But in time, it calmed down where I'm pretty strong-minded, and I don't try to let those too much. I try to stay strong. I don't like to let my mind wander too much like that. Of course, when you're dreaming, not much you can do about it. But it was a bad situation. The bodies were burnt beyond recognition. But a little story, when I, after I had pneumonia, and they were taking me back to Wright-Patterson, Dayton, Ohio, I went on by train, and I took Mr. Sachs back. I escorted his body back to Dayton. Well, when I got to Dayton, the undertaker, the mortuary people said Mrs. Sachs and their family wanted me to meet them next morning, and they put me up in a hotel. So I went to the funeral home next morning. They picked me up and took me there. And, of course, I'd explained to the mortuary what the condition was of the bodies. And he said, I wonder if you could speak to Mrs. Sachs. So we went in and introduced, you know, and shook hands. And I asked Mrs. Sachs, I said, I would like to talk to you in private. So we went in another room. I said, do you want me to tell you exactly what I saw and what I know? She says, I want you to. I said, well, you do not want to see your husband in this condition. I said, the only thing that's left is probably from above the knee to above the hip and a few other things. He said, that's all. She cried, gave me a hug. We went back outside, and she told the folks, she says, there will not be an open casket. And I had tears in my eyes.
Well, I can imagine those eyes have had tears in them a lot over the years. And the question that comes to my mind, I mean, from your second mission when you see your friends go down, to the mission where you bail out and your pilot's killed and the other gunner's killed, to this plane crash where everyone else is killed, and you walk into this room and you see the cylinder from that plane in a box in your bookcase over here. You're surrounded by reminders that it could have been you, and that you're very fortunate to be here. So what do you do with that? Has that changed your outlook on life? Do you take less for granted? How have you gone another 65 years since that crash with all of that in mind?
You know, if you're strong-minded, you know, and you're positive, I like to be a positive person. I don't think I've been negative more than 2 days in my whole life. I don't like to be that way. And I look at the reality of what went on. I realize that there were some tough, tough situations, but I was just fortunate, thank God, that I made it all through all that. And I've lived a good life. I'm happy. I've married to a wonderful woman, and she takes good care of me, and we're happy, and we're living in this beautiful country of Idaho on the Snake River. But you have to take it a day at a time. I know I think a lot. I'll be thinking, and I'll say to myself, what would have happened if that door hadn't went open? You know, I don't know. You know. I knew we were in serious trouble. If the door hadn't went open, when the airplane went upside down, I'd have been with him. But thank God I'm here.
Yeah, and you say thank God, and obviously he had quite the plan for your life. Most of us get a roller coaster, but you got the 3G-force roller coaster that you're surprised you survived. And something just hit me. You know, a lot of times I talk to guys who are prisoners of war or who survived something really fierce, and I talked to him about how they never would have made it back home from the war to meet their wife if it weren't for that. You just mentioned what a wonderful wife you have here in Esther and how you like to take her dancing and all that. It strikes me that your wife Esther here, you never would have met her if you weren't in that plane crash, because it was going back to look for that wreckage that you met her. Now, that's a pretty crazy twist there.
I stayed in this little bed and breakfast, and I walked up the sidewalk to the inn, and I saw Esther and her daughter Pam, and I thought to myself, oh boy, what a look what I see. Well, I was attracted to her immediately, and I went back home, and we talked a lot and on the phone, and finally I said, well, I think I need to come out to visit you. I want to see Idaho. So I come out to Idaho and didn't go back home. Got married on the 25th of November. Got married 5 years ago. a little confused on the date. And I have a wonderful wife. She has quite a history of her own, you know.
Yeah, and we won't get into all her business on the program here, but here in the San Joaquin Valley, we're proud to be the home of decathlon champions in Bob Mathias and Rafer Johnson, and now you have a decathlon champion in your family.
Yes, my wife is the mother of Bruce Jenner, the 1976 decathlon champ in Montreal. We enjoy his company periodically. Of course, they're way up in different areas where we are. No, I have a wonderful, wonderful wife. But I did rob the cradle. I'm 9 years older than her. But like these gentlemen here, I told them I'm going to shoot for 100, maybe 110.
And I'm just curious, not to belabor the point, but when a guy wins the decathlon, what do they call him? They call him the world's greatest athlete, right? And I'm sure you've told your survival stories to Bruce. And I'm curious, as a guy who held the title of the world's greatest athlete and someone that would expect to be able to survive more than just about anybody, does he think that he could have survived what you've survived?
Really, I don't know. You know, it's this thing that you just have to, you're like when I was in that little shed, I thought to myself, what am I going to do? Well, you know, I've been taught training. When I was in prison camp, I was taught how to find food if he was in a town. I remember when we was up on that little hillside, I was able to go down. Me and the lieutenant went down got into farm barns, you know. And when you're in a farm barn like that in Germany, you find the straw or the hay mile, you know. And then you just reach underneath, and guess what you find? You find potatoes. We made, in that 14, 15 days we was up on that mountain, we made at least 3 trips down there. And of course, you know, they call them kartoffels, but them potatoes are awful good, even raw.
Okay, now I've got to set this one up. Now, so Bruce Jenner, the Olympic decathlon champ, people famously have learned about his history the last few years because of his connection to the Kardashian family, and this is a family that's world famous. But I understand that the family member, the last time you were all together, that was talked about the most was the guy who's 94 years old. Is that true?
Well, and Esther's last birthday, which is her 85th birthday, Bruce and all of the 6 grandchildren, he chartered an airplane and flew in from California to here. And we met. We had a big dinner on a Saturday night. Then we had breakfast on Sunday morning. And, of course, they flew out again. They're busy people, you know. Young Brody is world famous, you know. All the girls love him. And Brandon is a great musician. They're really, really great, great people. And besides that, Bruce is a tremendous golfer. He's probably shooting about 3 or 4 over over par.
But they just wanted to talk about you.
Yeah, that's what I said. Esther talked to one of the girls, said they got home, and all they wanted to talk about, that old guy, 94 years old, still driving, and clear-minded, telling them all kind of stories. I promised them my stories. Well, they're on the mail. I just, after all this time, I finally got it finalized, and I sent it all to them, yeah. I'm correcting my World War II story. There's some changes I want to make in it. In my book now, it says 19 missions, but I found out later through the bomb group from the load list that I actually flew 27. I only had 3 more to go. Then I'd have went home, but it wasn't to be.
You got home. It was just a little different route that you took to get there. Last question for you. We've heard some crazy stories from you, and it's fitting that plane crash happened in the crazy mountains. That could not be more apropos. But with everything that you've been through, with everything you've experienced in your life, what are you most thankful for? And when you think about grandkids and the stories you want them to remember, what's the biggest thing you can pass on to them?
Well, I try to be a good father, and I try to be a good husband. I've been very fortunate. I've had two wonderful wives that passed away. By the way, my second wife was my sweetheart back when I was about 18, 19 years old in Youngstown, Ohio. And after Ruthie passed away, by the way, we were married 10 days short of 60 years. And then Millie and I were married by a little over 3 years. She died of cancer. And then I was, footloose and fancy free, and I went to Montana and met my new sweetheart.
Well, on behalf of all our listeners, I just want to say thank you for serving our country to begin with. Thank you for entertaining us with all your stories. And maybe we can meet again when you hit the century marks. That sound good to you?
That would be wonderful. Oh, let me add one more thing. 1948 in Golconda, Illinois, I was being reassigned to Alaska, and I was driving a car, and I lost control. I hit the biggest tree in the forest and broke my neck, and I was laid up for 7 months.
Anything else you've survived that we've left out today?
No, that's all. That's all. And I want to thank this gentleman for coming and doing this. This is wonderful.
Well, I know I say this every time, but the pleasure is all mine. And even though we've been listening to Frank Avery's story now the last two programs, there may be more updates to come. He hopes to publish a book about his experience. And also, through a little bit of research, I've learned a little more about Second Lieutenant Marshall Tetzstahl, the 22-year-old Fresno native who was killed along with five others in that 1946 crash that Frank survived. Tetzstahl is buried at Fresno's Belmont Memorial Park. He had been married less than 7 months before that tragedy occurred. And while I don't know yet what became of his widow, I do believe I've located his younger sister, who's now 85 years old. I'll try to connect her with Frank Avery, and we'll see what happens there. It's always amazing to me to see how things work out for each one of these veterans you hear on Hometown Heroes. The stories we've heard from Frank Avery are, I think, as impossible to predict as any we've heard on the program. One thing I can predict for you, some of the topics that we're going to be covering in the weeks ahead here on Hometown Heroes. If you haven't heard, the movie Red Tails is out. It's Valley native George Lucas's tribute to the Tuskegee Airmen, the pioneering African-American pilots who helped turn the tide in the air war in Europe. I plan on watching it soon and hopefully bringing you an interview with one of the pilots who inspired that film. And in a little less than a month, the Valley's Japanese-American community will again honor Nisei veterans of World War II and their families. You remember hearing about the Congressional Gold Medal. Many Nisei vets were able to make it to Washington, D.C. for that ceremony in November, but there are others who couldn't make it. And what about the families of those who are no longer with us? For those reasons, there will be a Congressional Gold Medal presentation for all of them at the Clovis Veterans Memorial District on February 19th at noon. If you want to take part in that, be there to witness that history. For more information on that event, you can call 554-1662. That's 434-1662. And finally, remember, if you have a veteran you want to tell me about, if you have one of those heroes in your hometown, send me an email, paul@kmjnow.com. That's paul@kmjnow.com. That's all for me. Till the Fresno State basketball game tonight from Reno, we'll have that tip-off for you at 7 o'clock tonight. Thanks so much for listening to Hometown Heroes on KMJ.